Welcome to the Engelsberg Ideas podcast, a discussion between leading writers, historians, and academics, hosted by Ian Martin.
A new American administration is getting down to work. Joe Biden is in the Oval Office. The disruptor, Donald Trump, is consigned to history, although he may not see it like that. He and his supporters may well be back for another go in subsequent electoral cycles. For now, though, allies and enemies of the US are keen to know what direction Biden will take his country in. In that context, on Engelsberg Ideas, in Inauguration Week, we've been examining the history and health of American democracy and its influence at home and abroad. Where does American democracy come from? What is the historical legacy? What are the next big challenges? For this podcast, I speak to leading experts and commentators in the field of foreign policy, posing a key question. After the drama and disruption of the last 4 years, can America lead again? Sir Nigel Sheinwald has a particular insight into the forces at work as international governments compete to find out how the new team will operate. He was UK ambassador to Washington from 2007 until 2012, witnessing the handover of power from George W. Bush to Barack Obama during the financial crisis. This time, the Biden administration is keen to assemble a coalition of friendly powers who might deal with a more powerful and assertive China. I began by asking Sir Nigel to describe the race for influence when there is a new president in town.
Well, I think you've got essentially, two jobs when that's happening. There's intense interest back at home, from people who are very well informed themselves. They've got many other sources of information. So an embassy always has to work ultimately in a competitive environment with other news and advice sources. But the first thing that you have to do is you have to explain what's happening, analyze the emerging policy picture from the administration as it gets going, first in transition and then obviously after the inauguration, and convey that to London in a way that ministers understand and adapt to the new reality. And the second side of it is more the operational side of it. It's making sure as early as possible, ideally well before the election and well before this moment of truth, that you know the key players yourself as an ambassador, and that you're in a good position to move into an operational relationship with people, and most importantly, facilitate the relationship between incoming people at the White House and in the cabinet room with their opposite numbers in London, and try and knit together those relationships as fast as possible. And I think I'd be dishonest if I didn't say that, there's a certain amount of pressure normally at this time of the year, just around inauguration time, about when the incoming president is going to make initial contact with foreign leaders, see foreign leaders. This time, in-person meetings are obviously complicated by COVID, so that may take the pressure off to some degree. I just don't know. But that's always one of the Washington games in the early months, is who gets in first, on what level and with what degree of access. And you're obviously part of that and in the swim with that.
Yeah, presumably governments around the world are, as you said, trying to or competing to get a hearing from the new administration. Is it then really just a case of you relying on your contacts, historical links, or do you have to be open to surprises?
You have to rely on your links. You have to rely on links that ministers, officials, others in London, have built up themselves over the years. I think what you have to do above all is use the period of the transition. Once you know who's going to be president and you know who's going to come into their team, you have to use that with your home capital, in our case London, really to work out what our offer is. And that's what we certainly did at the beginning of the Obama administration. I think every government in London does that at the time of a presidential inauguration, particularly when the president is changing. And what I mean by your offer is where you could make a difference, where your advice and your contribution is going to be most useful. 12 years ago, at the time of Obama's election, when I was there, There were a range of issues, but the very top one for Gordon Brown and for his government was the handling on an international basis of the financial crisis, which was in full swing, and where the UK had very ambitious ideas for making a more concerted international response, beginning with the G20 summit, which we subsequently hosted in April of 2009. But that was top of Gordon Brown's agenda for very obvious reasons. We had quite a lot to offer because he'd, having been a finance minister himself for a decade, he was clearly one of the international leaders in trying to fashion a response. But then on foreign policy, you've got to work out where the UK has a particular voice, role, where it's got intelligence, which is of particular importance and value, where we have operational links which can be helpful. And I hope that that process was going on now in some detail. It's pretty obvious what the priorities will be for a Biden administration, but you need to work that out with them once they get into office and gradually become open to more structured dialogue with other governments. And that's going to be, that's always in the American system, not an entirely smooth process just because of the nature of the clean out that happens at the end of every administration and the vagaries of the nomination and appointment process.
So Joe Biden is now president. What is his inheritance internationally?
I think his inheritance internationally is twofold. I mean, I think that the first honest thing to say is you need to strip Trump out and work out some long-term trends about American power, which would affect their relationship with the rest of the world anyway. And I think you can see that. It wasn't as if, even 4 years ago, it was already clear that America was stepping back somewhat from its traditionally assertive and highly active international role. You had this idea of strategic reticence, of standing back, letting others take the burden. You had an Asia pivot, which caused some concern in Europe about their place in the sun or lack of place in the sun. So there was already, in the wake of the financial crisis and the failure of Iraq and Afghanistan, there was already a recalibration of American policy going on. And then, of course, that was turbocharged and taken in a fundamentally different direction by the ultimately destructive and disruptive attitude to foreign policy and to international engagement generally by Trump. So I think you've ended up with a world where there are some very obvious trends which would have been in place anyway: the rise of China, the place of countries like India, Brazil, and so on, handling a huge international issue like climate change. Those would have been difficult and problematic in any event. But the destruction of the not complete destruction, but the weakening of the international system, the willful weakening of the international system under Trump, is the first thing that I think Biden will try to and will be able to some degree to repair quite quickly, because coming back into the mainstream of at least participation in these international activities will be helpful. And he can quite quickly make the first steps in repairing some sense of returning some sense of equilibrium to relationships with allies, which are very frayed around the edges after 4 years of aggro from Trump.
Are there elements of Trumpism, though, that he will incorporate in his approach? There's already a bipartisan agreement almost on China and the reality that China is the major foreign policy challenge, and that being more robust when it comes to China is going to shape American policy.
Yes, I think there is on China. I think clearly something has moved over the past few years on China. In part, that's a change in American tolerance and receptiveness, but also it's about changes in China as well, plainly. That has happened. I don't think it would be right to caricature the previous administration's policy, or even the Bush administration's policies, as pacific or naive in relation to China, but they would have drawn the line a little bit differently in terms of the where they were on the arc between cooperation and confrontation, I think they would have drawn it differently from people today. So there has been a move. Whether there's a consensus on the detail of how to manage it, I would question somewhat. And I think that the main point that Biden and his team will want to do, and you've seen that Kurt Campbell is going to be involved again as the Asia-Pacific coordinator in the White House. I think the main thing that they'll want to do is to bring a certain consistency and predictability into policy with China. With Trump, you had one moment, a love-in with President Xi and an admiration of him personally, and the next minute another round of tariff increases and brandishing the stick and threatening a trade war. So that oscillation between the two and the lack of a center of gravity in American policy and a sense of linking it to linking up the different elements in policy and working with regional and international allies, all that was absent. And I'm sure that that Biden, Tony Blinken, Kurt Campbell and others will be working to try and draw the threads of American power together in the classic way and try to handle things differently and produce a policy which is, which is tougher, I think, than in the past, but nevertheless contains elements of outreach and engagement with China, not least on things like climate, where they'll want to recreate the American-Chinese core, which produced the Paris Agreement 5 years ago.
What do you make of the main foreign policy appointments made by Biden? How should we read those appointments?
I think we should read them with great encouragement because they're a hugely experienced and well-qualified group. They have a traditional view of American power. I suppose the issue is less can they do their jobs than, does anyone have the brilliance and the creativity to deal with this disintegrating world and a world where their political bosses are going to be very preoccupied with handling the domestic problems that America has and without solving which, they won't be able to restore American prestige and traction in the world in any event. So they've got to start with the domestic, restoring some sense of domestic confidence and stability. That is completely right. I think that there's a huge measure of reassurance in the team that he's produced. They know the UK, they know the rest of Europe. I think we're lucky to have a team like that.
One of the clearest pointers we have to how Biden will run his foreign policy in the next 4 years is the foreign policy statement which he published in Foreign Policy magazine in the spring of 2020. And he talked in that about restoring the idea of American democracy at home and leading abroad. Do you think America can lead again?
I think it can lead again. I think it would be a different sort of leadership, a less indisputable, indispensable, to use that word, type of leadership than 30 years ago. I think that's unavoidable. And the world is plainly a much more contested space than it was. I'd also be a little careful on the democracy point because undoubtedly it's important, but I think until America puts its own house more in order, I would be more cautious than I sense is the case in the UK and the US about having great democracy summits and things like that, which I think are a little bit difficult for others to stomach, particularly if they lead to new boundaries being created in international relations, which wouldn't be profitable, I think, for us in the sensible for us in the long run. So I'm a little bit nervous about this accentuation. I think America's got some questions to ask about its democracy and about the sustainability of its system at the moment. It certainly won't restore its international standing without some changes and without more stability at home.
A case of show, not tell. Sir Nigel Sheinwald, thank you very much for joining us. Sir Nigel Sheinwald. Can America really turn it around? To discuss this, I brought together Professor Joseph Nye and Dr. Karen von Hippel. Karen von Hippel is Director General of RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, the defence and security think tank based in London. Professor Nye is Distinguished Service Professor at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and a former advisor to the US government. He argued in the 1990s against the prevailing narrative of American declinism and pioneered the theory of soft power in pursuit of American interests. Where stands America's reputation today, and what can we expect from the Biden era?
Well, in the very short run, it's been damaged. It's been damaged by 4 years of the Trump administration turning its back on alliances with, of course, one of America's great strengths. It's been damaged by the inept way in which we responded to the COVID pandemic. And it's been damaged by the recent events in Trump supporters storming the Capitol. So if one were to take a short-run view of just the last few years, I'd say American reputation, soft power has definitely diminished. On the other hand, something I've argued in the past is that there's an extraordinary amount of resilience in American society and democracy. After all, if you go back to the 1960s, we had major assassinations, we had cities in flames, we had the National Guard shooting students at Kent Place. And of course, after the honesty of Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter and the optimism of Ronald Reagan, we pretty well recovered within the next decade. I think we're at a similar point now with Biden replacing Trump. Nothing's a sure thing. If we don't get the pandemic under control, if we don't get the economy revived, we can't get the national reconciliation we need. But I suspect that we are going to be able to do that. So, short run, yes, decline. Longer term, meaning over a decade, I'm more optimistic.
Karen von Hippel, are you optimistic about the potential for American recovery?
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here today. It's obviously a pleasure to be and an honor to be doing this with Professor Nye. I guess I look at it slightly differently. You know, the world is always changing and it's becoming more multipolar and China is more assertive. And America's withdrawal pretty much completely from, you know, every international alliance, organization, partnership over the last 4 years has changed events on the ground because absence of leadership is even worse in a sense than bad leadership. And so many countries have been asserting themselves in ways that they wouldn't have been able to before. So we are just in a very different place. And America, in many respects, has been humbled by the last 4 years. It's still an incredibly strong country. All of America's allies are desperate to work with America again. They're delighted that America's back. But I do think they're going to be nervous that, you know, Trumpism is still very popular. We all know he won 11 million more votes than he did in 2016. And the threat of another even more effective Trump in at the next election is going to be out there. And so what do they need to do to, you know, to build resilience into whatever agreements and partnerships that they put in place with the United States? And I don't know the answer to that.
This is fascinating, Professor Nye, that around the inauguration in Washington, there was this sense of the American political establishment rallying with this footage, incredible viewing of former President Obama, Clinton, and Bush producing this joint video on inauguration evening, hymning the glories of American democracy and the resilience of the system. But as Karen suggests there, there's still a very strong strand of Trumpism and populism. And this is not over in terms of the Republican Party, is it? Do you think it will just go back to establishment politics that easily?
No, I think Karen is right. The Trump years did leave a residue, and as Senator McConnell said, these people were fed a menu of lies, and if he remains a political force in American politics, that's going to be a big lump for the political system to dissolve, and it doesn't happen quickly or easily. With that said, however, I think what's interesting is the point you made about the underlying Democratic attitude. What's fascinating to me is that something a case like the Secretary of State of Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, a staunch Republican, who Trump tried to browbeat into finding him 11,000 votes that he could take Georgia. And he said, no, facts don't support it. What strikes me is that whether it was Republicans or Democrats or independents, at the level of local officials, you had a staunch feeling of, standing up for what is right in democracy. And I think that's the source of strength. I think the symbolism was important, but I think more important was the underlying strength of the institution. So I think there is an underlying resilience in American democracy and that symbolism of the inauguration. But I think more important than the symbolism, Lucy, is that people like Raffensperger stood up and did the right thing.
Karen von Hippel, what are the challenges in foreign policy terms facing the incoming administration?
Well, they have first to clean up the mess created by Trump. Then they have to rebuild relationships with partners. They, of course, have to deal with an assertive China, as I mentioned. And I think they'll do that with partners. I think Trump made a mistake by thinking America could do everything on its own, and it just can't. And China's too big for any one country to try to manage, really, on its own. I mean, China is a partner, but it's also a competitor and a rival. So that's incredibly complicated. And then, of course, there's all sorts of global issues, climate change, how to better prepare for another future catastrophe along with U.S. partners, how to rebuild international institutions. I mean, unfortunately, the U.N. has been fairly moribund these last 4 years. It's been on a slow, gradual decline. And these institutions do matter. So there are enormous challenges. There are enormous challenges domestically in the U.S., as Professor Nye was discussing earlier, but also overseas. Now, if I could just say one quick thing, is I think America should be careful not to assume that America can solve all these problems. Some of these problems are just enormous problems, and they will last for a long time. So it's more about trying to mitigate, to manage, and to resolve conflicts, et cetera, where possible, but not assume that America can solve all these problems.
And Karen von Hippel, how do you think the outside world, primarily in terms of the national security and intelligence communities and defense, the area you know so well, how do you think they view America and this transition to Biden?
I think they are breathing an enormous sigh of relief. As I mentioned earlier, America had largely been AWOL for the last 4 years, and no country or groupings of countries came in to fill that void. Now, I suspect if Trump had won again, we might see something different. We might see some sort of association of like-minded states just plowing ahead without America. But they're all very happy that America's going to be back and leading. It's going to be a different type of leadership. It's going to be a more humble leadership and one that's more respectful of partnerships. I mean, I think that the Obama administration was also much more respectful, but we had before that, as Professor and I mentioned, when we had the war in Iraq, that whole with us or against us attitude. And then similarly, when Trump basically just tried to bulldoze other countries. And so I do think, that's Biden's natural, that's his whole MO is working with others, whether it's Republicans in the Congress or with America's allies and even adversaries. He really is the type of person who wants to extend a hand and try to have a conversation. I think he can be tough if he needs to be, but I don't think that's going to be his first instinct at all.
Let's consider two challenges. One, which is obvious, which is China, and the sense that the democracies need to get organized, and there seems to be some confusion about how to deal with China. Look at the deal that the European Union just did with China. Biden wants to be pretty robust. Biden also wants to be robust on Russia, though that's a different story. But so China is the first challenge. And then the second challenge, Karen von Hippel, is surely the security and intelligence challenge, which is that the next 4 years could throw up all manner of wild cards, not least of which is terrorism or the next phase of the pandemic. But terrorism particularly hardly gets a mention anymore.
I think American policy on China for the last, well, really since Nixon, has been one of strategic engagement. You engage with the country and we hope that it learns to become democratic and respect human rights. Obviously, that hasn't happened. I think there was a similar slight naivety with Russia after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I think in many ways, Trump was the first American president to publicly say that policy with China was failing, even though Obama behind the scenes recognized it. But the answer is, I don't know, you know, what replaces it. Now, obviously, a policy of containment or marginalizing China wouldn't have worked. And it just needs to be far more bespoke. And the Chinese are incredibly, they're just obviously, you know, incredibly powerful country. And they've been spending money. They've been all over the place, including in Europe. And they've been very overt and very clever about making friends, whether that's inside the European space or in South America or in other parts of the world, in Africa and elsewhere. So China is a difficult one. And, you know, America wants to work with China, but it's not clear how much China is going to compromise. And that is going to be a challenge.
Yeah, on the terrorism question, it's taken a back seat, hasn't it? It's rarely mentioned now because we're all focused, obviously, on the pandemic, and China gets a lot of attention. But there are threats out there, aren't there?
Well, I mean, I think actually the focus on terrorism, not just in the US but elsewhere, will be on the right wing variant, which, as we've seen in America, is much bigger than many people thought. The FBI, for a number of years, has said that right-wing terrorism, right-wing extremism, has been more of a threat in the United States than the jihadist Islamist type. So I think, and we've seen that in other parts of the world, whether that's in New Zealand or in the UK, Germany, etc. But that also being said, whatever groups are inspired by the so-called Islamic State are still going to be out there, and will likely see, you know, the evil son of ISIL in the near future, which will be a more of a virtual attempt to build some sort of virtual caliphate out there. So, you know, yes, of course, terrorism has been a little bit quiet on the Islamist side, but certainly not on the right-wing side, as we've seen in the States even.
History shows time and again that when it comes to the American presidency, the personality of the incumbent can make a big difference in terms of outcomes. And Professor Nye, in your latest book, Do Morals Matter? Presidents and Foreign Policy from FDR to Trump, you identify, I think, three factors: intention, execution, and outcome. And you rank presidents. Firstly, how does Trump, it's now all over, how does Trump fare? And what, very early, too early to say perhaps, but what are your expectations and hopes on Biden's capabilities?
Well, of the 14 presidents since 1945, I divided them in three categories. The top four, who's our first President Bush, and then a group in between, and then a bottom four. The bottom four were basically Lyndon Johnson because of Vietnam, and Richard Nixon because of Vietnam, and George W. Bush because of Iraq. But then in that bottom tier is Donald Trump. I think the one saving grace in people who will look back on his foreign policy will say he did realize the problem that China posed. He did a little bit in the Middle East, and he avoided any major foolish interventions. But that's not enough to get him out of the bottom tier. As for Biden, obviously much too soon to tell on day two, but I think his attitude toward, and Karen mentioned this earlier, toward alliances, his experience with the international institutions and with having been chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, as well as vice president under Obama, I think these are things that suggest a direction of his foreign policy, which is going to be one that plays to American strengths, which is the ability to organize others. If you go back to this question of China, China has about zero allies, unless you count North Korea. And if they add North Korea as an ally, it's not clear that's a plus or a minus sign. But for the United States, there are about 60 countries that have some form of relationship with the U.S., and that's a huge advantage. So that if you look at East Asia, which has its own internal balance of power, countries like India, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, they want the Americans present because essentially we provide the balance to China. They don't want a Cold War with China, but they don't want to be abandoned to China either. So I think Biden understands that and will play to that strength in terms of a foreign policy. But it's, as I said, early to make any judgments.
Karen von Hippel, it's very early days in the Biden administration, but do you think he has what it takes?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think he's the man for the moment. He's not perhaps the most charismatic speaker, although I thought he did a very good job yesterday at the inauguration, and he's known for being loquacious. But he really, he's deeply steeped in foreign policy, as Professor Nye said. I think he knows pretty much every foreign leader and every opposition leader. And, you know, he's worked with, you know, he doesn't need the tutorial that past American presidents needed at the start in foreign affairs. And so he and his team can hit the ground running. They're all incredibly experienced. They know pretty much, I mean, all I hear in London is, oh, well, we know the whole team. We're looking forward to working with them. And so I think that's going to expedite matters. But there are enormous challenges out there. I mean, we have, you know, as we discussed, and I guess one slightly different issue I just wanted to raise, and I don't know if Professor and I would agree or not, I slightly wonder if the end of Trump may herald the end of these other populist leaders. Because don't forget, it's still, no matter what, it'll be difficult to deal with Modi, with, you know, with countries in India, with countries such as Poland, Hungary, other parts of the world where there's still these populist leaders, the Philippines, Brazil, et cetera. And I wonder if Trump losing his election may, you know, may be the beginning of the end of these other leaders, or if they'll still be quite strong and dominant. You know, you still have Putin, Xi, and others out there. And so none of these leaders are going to be easy to deal with, whatever your personality is.
Professor Nye.
I think that Karen is onto something in the sense that I suspect that the populist moment may have peaked. I think the Bolsonaros and Orbans and so forth feel a certain loss of not having Trump as their standard bearer in the U.S. On the other hand, it will weaken some of those populist authoritarians. It won't really weaken the true authoritarians like Putin and Xi Jinping, who really are not populists. They're much more traditional authoritarians. So we're not out of the woods, but I do think there's something in her observation.
Do you think also, though, Karen von Hippel, that we know from history that pandemics, like major conflicts, make politics even more unpredictable than usual, and that they unleash economic and social forces which could take politics internationally in some very strange directions post-pandemic, just considering the scale of the harm that's been done to economies?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And in fact, we talked about this recently at RUSI, because one of the politicians that had been in charge in the UK during the 2007-2008 financial crisis said, you know, none of us anticipated that a decade plus on, the response to what we did would be in many ways these populist leaders coming back. And I think we do need to be thinking now, you know, where might we be in the next 5-10 years, given the state, the extent of state intervention in pretty much every economy, every major economy out there, and that, you know, there will be financial challenges, recessions, et cetera, in most European and North American countries for the foreseeable future, at least for a year or two. It's hard to say. I mean, you know, maybe there will be a bounce back, but it's going to be challenged with the extent of debt out there. So where might we be? And I think we probably should be thinking through that question, Ian, in a much more systematic way.
Dr. Karen von Hippel, Professor Joseph Nye, thank you very much for joining us.
Professor Joseph Nye and Dr. Karen von Hippel. Is there a danger, though, of seeing this purely from the American perspective? The global balance of power has shifted with the rise of China, and allies in Europe see the world differently now. This is not the Cold War when America led its allies and got its way. I spoke to Tom McTague, a staff writer with The Atlantic magazine and a leading transatlantic commentator on geopolitics. In his latest piece, he says that Biden faces a tricky time with Europe. The problem won't be easy to resolve.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't want to overplay it. You know, this isn't a problem as big as, you know, a nuclear proliferation or, you know, the strategic rise of China or even Russia. You know, this is a different problem, but it is complicated and it is new, I think, to some extent. This is a problem of Europe, how it sees itself, and America, how it sees its role as the leader of the West. Europe is increasingly agitating for more autonomy, what they call strategic autonomy, which has been a sort of French obsession for a long time, but is increasingly becoming something that is that other countries, particularly Germany, are aspiring to as well. Now, this creates a problem that we can see most obviously in the recent China deal that the EU struck, in that strategic autonomy, having autonomy, which means from the US, can mean that the European Union does things that the US doesn't like. Now, what does it do at that point? And when it comes to China, it's a real problem for the US, because this is now its great strategic challenge for the 21st century. Now, is the European Union an ally? Is there a West which is lining up to contain China or not? This is a fundamental question, and the European Union seems to want to position itself as a kind of non-aligned power, somewhere in the middle that can make the best of both. Now, the US might just decide, well, that's no good for us, especially if we're spending, you know, all this money, twice as much as Europe, on Europe's defence.
And the European Union did something extraordinary during the transition between American administrations, in that it actually signed a deal with China. Explain what that deal is all about.
Yes, it is extraordinary that they did that in the weeks before Joe Biden became president. This had been a deal that had been in the works for a decade or so. And, you know, ironically, it was Britain and the European Commission together who were initially the most positive about this, who were pushing for this to happen. If you go back and think of the golden era that Britain was seeking to establish with China under David Cameron and George Osborne, that has obviously completely changed. But what happened in the last few months is that under Angela Merkel's leadership, she and Macron pushed for this deal with China to be pushed over the line before Biden became president. They wanted this deal, which is an economic partnership with China, an investment vehicle, so that each side can invest in each other's countries more easily and trade with each other. They wanted this deal done before Biden came in because they wanted to assert their autonomy and to ensure that they weren't dragged into a Western alliance against China that they know full well Biden is looking to establish. And one of the realities here is that this is a, in some senses, a legacy of Trump's presidency that will far outlast him. There is now a bipartisan consensus in Washington that China is a strategic threat and they need to change their long-term position of engagement with China.
If the assumption had been, and I certainly assumed that this would be the case, and it was a widespread assumption among commentators and observers, that the Biden administration would attempt to assemble that coalition of interests. Perhaps Boris Johnson's talked about the D10 of democracies, which is Five Eyes, the security and the intelligence partnership, plus other allied democracies against China. Well, this undermines that strategy. Do you agree?
It does to some extent. I think it's a very tricky situation where we... where a lot is in flux at the moment, and we don't know how it's going to fall. You know, what are these new institutional arrangements that are going to be set up under Biden's leadership? So, for example, we have the D10, as you mentioned, which is this alliance of democracies. That is something Biden is trying to set up as well. Britain is using its chair of the G7. To effectively create this by inviting three other democracies, India, South Korea, and Australia, to come on board, and that will happen in July in Cornwall. Now, that is the first iteration of this idea, and the French and the Germans are quite concerned about this. They're a little bit hesitant. They're going to engage with it, well, primarily because they have no choice. It's Britain who gets to invite people, but. They don't want to scupper it. They don't want to frustrate Biden, but they're also quite reluctant. You know, they will say, well, what about Russia? What do we do with Turkey? What do we do with India, which is, you know, is becoming more authoritarian? What do we do with other powers or other countries that will be important if our prime goal is to contain China? But ultimately, they just don't want a big alliance against China. They want to keep China in the system and they want to get rich from trade with China. Now, America has tried that for a few decades now and they've changed their position. So we have a fundamental tension now in the Western alliance.
This is a fascinating point. And you observe in your latest piece in The Atlantic that the reality is still that the United States is the guarantor of Western European security and defense. How do you think Americans, the new administration and others will view this new tension, paying on the one hand for European security and defense, but also learning that the world has changed really quite radically since Barack Obama became president in 2008. It's a very different Europe.
It's a very different Europe indeed. I think they will react over time in a way that lots of presidents have reacted to this and lots of US administrations have reacted to this with frustration and anger. This is not just Donald Trump who has complained about Europeans trying to have their cake and eat it to some extent. This goes way back beyond that. Barack Obama tried to get European countries to increase their defense commitments because of the frustration that the US was spending something like 4% of its GDP on defense, and almost no countries in Europe were spending 2%. So this is a long-held frustration, and the US sees itself and its own economic problems, and it looks to Europe and it sees countries like Germany doing incredibly well, and they ask a perfectly legitimate question, which is, you know, why are we effectively paying for your defence? This only gets further irritations, kind of further exacerbated when they see that Germany is seeking deals with Russia for Nord Stream, or now pushing for deals with China, which is the strategic threat that they face. So I think you're going to see frustration, and this is quite an interesting next few years, because in one sense, you know, the Democratic Party now look to Europe and they see Angela Merkel as a kind of liberal hero to some extent, who stood up to Trump. She didn't sort of hold hands with him like Theresa May, or be described as a kind of Britain Trump like Boris Johnson. And yet she is the one whose positions clash with President Biden's, whereas Boris Johnson has moved Britain into a position where on almost every single foreign policy question now, Britain is aligned with the United States. And that's not a coincidence, whether it's on climate change or, you know, vaccination funding, defense spending, China now, Five Eyes, all of these things, Britain has positioned itself well. So you've got a tension here between the politics and the visuals of Boris Johnson and the reality of his positions.
There's also the question of the economy. And as you point out, we might like to think in Europe of American decline, but actually, if you look at the numbers, the US share of the global economy, as you put it, has not only held, but it's increased since 2010 from 23% to 25%. And that's according to the IMF data. And Europe's has shrunk in the same period from 21.5% to 17.5%. And that includes Britain in the total as well. So it's maybe not quite as people assume.
Yeah, I think America is at a really interesting point here. You know, obviously it has deep political divisions, and these are genuine problems. They're not made up. They're not small problems. It has problems getting things passed in Congress. All of these things that we know about, it has a sort of an angry minority that is set against this Biden presidency. It's also a country with extraordinary strength still, and strengths that actually far outweigh many European strengths. If you only have to go to the US at the moment and go to the cities that are booming in the South, whether Atlanta or Austin, or over to California, and you can see the economic power that is still there. The number of companies and tech companies that are leading this sort of new revolution. There is a fear among European diplomats that I've spoken to that Europe could become a kind of like China during the first industrial revolution, where it was just left behind. It didn't have the industrial capacity that Europe or now China has. So it's a kind of protective group of a wealthy part of the world, but doesn't have that industrial base. That is the fear among some Europeans. The US clearly has the technology and the wherewithal to continue to keep growing if it can get past its political different problems. And you know, it might. Look at the situation it's in today. The Democrats now control all three branches of the federal government. There are states throughout the US that are absolutely booming. There is a potential here that they can sort their problems out democratically, and their economy can drive them on, just as it's driven the country through the pandemic with much less of much less severe recessions than we've seen in Europe.
Do you think it can use that economic power to lead internationally? Can, in essence, after the disruption of the Trump era, can America lead again?
I think it can. I think what it can't do is be the leader it was in the 1950s or the 1960s, when its share of GDP was much higher, global GDP was much higher than it is today. You know, we are not going to see America entirely supreme. Even the 1990s were a bit of a sort of fake supremacy when we look back at it now. But that was a moment of extraordinary American strength when they were intervening, you know, in the Balkans. Any conflict that came about, you would see American presence there. Even in the UK, you know, if you think back to the Good Friday Agreement and the place, the influence that the US had, it's kind of hard to see that now. You see conflicts in the Eastern Mediterranean, say, or in the Caucasus, or indeed some of the problems in Northern Ireland. American leadership, it has withdrawn from those areas. I'm not sure it's going to come back in quite the way it was, but it is still the biggest economy, the most powerful country, and it will be for a very long time. So I think it's more of a leadership of other states that share its interests and values more than American supremacy alone. And that is really the challenge for Biden. Can he assemble this new alliance that is led by America, but he is not in total control? And can Europe find a way to position itself into that world, Britain included, but also countries like Japan, Australia, Canada, and I think crucially, India?
Tom McTague of The Atlantic. America is a nation that specializes in rebirth and reinvention. The inauguration ceremony itself, with somber religious overtones and schmaltzy hoopla to follow, is a manifestation of the American ideal, the search for improvement rooted in an emphasis on freedom. Now, as we've heard, America's allies are looking to see if a new team can instigate an improvement internationally too. It won't be easy for the new president, navigating a divided country and a complex global situation. It's doubtful there will be a return to normalcy anytime soon. Still, America has been written off many times before and re-emerged as a global leader. What struck me looking at the events in Washington this week was that for all an imperfect America has terrible problems, and it does, it is nonetheless a noisy democracy, a place where the people decide and there is a chance to rebuild. The contrast with its totalitarian rivals is stark. I certainly hope America can lead again. Thank you for listening.
The Engelsberg Ideas podcast is from the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.